Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from appellant in State Bar v. Humphreys.
May it please the court, Ms. Linda Acevedo will present argument for appellant.
May it please the court, the only genuine issue involved in this case is whether the criminal offense of willful tax evasion is a crime involving moral turpitude. It's our position that it is, and that the Board of Disciplinary Appeals erred in concluding otherwise.
So, Savannah, before you get into that, how about the propriety of this appeal in the first place? If we don't have any should not take jurisdiction over this appeal.
First of all, with respect to the jurisdictional issue, I think it's clear that the disciplinary procedural rule, specifically 7.11, does not limit which party can appeal. It simply says that an appeal from a determination of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals will be to the Supreme Court. That rule 4.06, which talks about the duties and responsibilities of the commission, places the commission in the same posture as any other client would, with all the rights that any other client would have. And when an adverse decision is issued against a client, they have the ability to appeal that decision. That the chief disciplinary counsel acts as counsel for the commission and carries out whatever wishes the client, in this particular instance, to appeal the case to this court to do. That the argument that 7.08 makes the Board of Disciplinary Appeals the final arbiter with respect to these kinds of cases simply is not stated in the rule. All it really says is that the Board of Disciplinary Appeals has original jurisdiction or takes the place of, under the old rules, with the trial court, the position the trial court would have been in considering compulsory discipline cases. That the argument about Rule 15.08, that we're outside the statute of limitations, first of all, that wasn't raised before the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, and second of all, if you read that rule, it accepts or exempts compulsory discipline matters. And finally, I believe that Mr. Humphreys makes some statement to the fact that we did not file the rule regarding applications of writ of error, and obviously this is not an application of writ of error, so I don't believe that that particular rule is applicable in this case. So I think it's clear that this court has jurisdiction to review a determination of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, and in fact has done so in the past already.
Is it your contention that the Board of Disciplinary Appeals decision should be reversed on either basis upon which Mr. Humphreys was convicted, that is, on a willful attempt to evade taxes, or willful filing of a false tax return?
I believe that the reversal would have to be based upon the fact that the willful evasion of taxes, which is a felony, is one which involves moral turpitude, and that in deciding or concluding that it is not a crime of moral turpitude, that they were in error in doing so.
So we're not concerned with the filing of a false tax return?
We are concerned in the sense that the means by which the evasion occurred was by the filing of the false tax return. And I believe that the problem that the board found themselves in is that the filing of the false tax return was a misdemeanor offense. I think they believed that that in and of itself was moral turpitude. However, since he received under a year, which I believe is what determines whether it's a felony or misdemeanor in federal cases, that they did not have the ability to hear it under the rule because the rule speaks to misdemeanors involving theft, embezzlement, misappropriation of property. And so I think that they felt they were restricted to looking to the felony aspect of the case.
Do you agree that a misdemeanor cannot be a serious crime? I'm sorry, cannot be a serious crime and therefore cannot be an intentional crime which will allow disbarment?
No, because the rule itself talks about misdemeanors involving theft, and I believe theft is a serious crime.
So do you disagree with the Board of Disciplinary Appeals saying they couldn't consider the misdemeanor false tax filing?
I believe that the filing of a false tax return is not theft or embezzlement or misappropriation of funds, although I suppose, and I think it was argued at the time, that I suppose you could make some argument that the money really belongs to the government, and in a sense you're misappropriating that. And I guess if we found ourselves in that position, that's what we would argue to the board.
Do you think the board can ever go behind a conviction to look and reweigh whether or not in its opinion that conviction was warranted or justified, or is it an automatic process with the state bar? Once a court of competent jurisdiction has decided something, that it has a res judicata or a collateral estoppel effect?
The position is that you can't go behind the judgment. There are several things that point to that. First of all, Rule 8.02 specifically says that once you introduce the record of conviction, that the guilt of the lawyer is conclusively established. So that's one thing. The second thing is that the utility of the compulsory discipline scheme, to me, that you would lose the utility of the scheme if you were forced to relitigate the facts again. I mean, why bother having compulsory discipline if you have to go back and relitigate the guilt or innocence of the individual? And third, say for example, if you have theft, everybody seems to agree that that's moral turpitude. Well, it oughtn't matter whether you stole a dollar or whether you stole $1 million. The point is that you stole and that you've been convicted of theft. It oughtn't matter that I bribed an elected official with $20 or $20,000. The bottom line is that the offense in and of itself is moral turpitude. It's the same argument here. It doesn't make any difference whether you withheld and made a specific misrepresentation, filed a false tax return by omitting 5% of your income or 85% of your income. The bottom line is you're dealing with a criminal act that involves intentional dishonesty for the purpose of personal gain. And so I think it's absolutely inappropriate to go behind the facts of a case in determining either the guilt or innocence of an individual. And finally, and I guess I suppose I should have mentioned this first, this court in and of itself has held in Heard versus the State Bar that the issue is strictly a question of law, that there's not a factual determination involved here. And so I think it's pretty clear that there are reasons why you don't go into the facts of the case. Now, if you're in a position, once you make the determination to whether or not the crime involves moral turpitude, if the board is in a position in which it's going to exercise its discretion with respect to discipline, that's not the case that we have. That's not the situation in this case because Mr. Humphreys did not receive a fully probated sentence. But the rule says if you receive a fully probated sentence, then the board could either suspend you for the term of your probation or disbar you. And I believe the court has affirmed that discretion in a recent case, affirmation of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals in Gina Cecil. Then it might matter whether you stole a dollar or $1 million, if you're going to decide what the appropriate discipline is. Whether you took the money to feed your family or you took the money and bought a Maserati, it may make a difference with respect to whether or not you think the individual should be suspended or should be disbarred.
Is there a practical difference in this sense, in that the Board of Disciplinary Appeals can suspend a lawyer, but if the lawyer is disbarred, the lawyer can file for reinstatement in 5 years, can they not?
If a lawyer is disbarred, if he's disbarred on the basis of a conviction, then what the rule provides now is you have to wait 5 years after the restoration of your civil liberty to apply for reinstatement. And normally that would at least include that you would be out of prison and off parole and a five-year period where you have no strings attached. In other words, it doesn't really count when you're on probation or parole because you have to be good, because if you're not good, bad things happen to you. So what they want to see is 5 years with no strings attached in which you, you know, conduct yourself in the way you want members of our profession to do so. In this context, I think it's important to look to the Texas case of Muniz versus the State, which involved an individual who was convicted of possession of marijuana with intent to distribute. In that case, the court found that it was a crime of moral turpitude and set out some disjunctive definitions of what moral turpitude involved, beginning with anything done knowingly, contrary to justice, honesty, principle, or good morals. More importantly, Muniz requires, in deciding the question, that you consider the fact that the crime was committed by a lawyer as opposed to a layperson. That a lawyer is held to a more strict standard because he is in a position of public trust, that he assumes a responsibility to the law itself and that any serious disregard of that law should be considered more grave. Also, respectfully, remind this court that it has also affirmed a decision of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals that simple possession of cocaine is a crime of moral turpitude. That was in the case of Jesus Santos. Texas itself hasn't decided this issue as far as tax evasion goes, but there are numerous decisions out of Supreme Court in other jurisdictions which have found that willful tax evasion is a crime of moral turpitude. There's the Supreme Court in Illinois, West Virginia, the Supreme Courts of Minnesota, New York, North Dakota. I think it's significant that both in the Illinois case, Henry Sullivan, and the West Virginia case, Henry Mann, they talk about that you need to look at the nature of the crime itself, not the facts and circumstances surrounding the crime. In addition, the Supreme Court of California has also held it to be a crime of moral turpitude and specifically says you're looking at a crime where the lawyer engaged in intentional dishonesty for personal gain. And if you want to look at the facts at all, the only facts that are in evidence, I suppose, is the fact that Mr. Humphreys was convicted of 4 counts of willful evasion and 1 count of the failure to file, in other words, the means in which it was accomplished. And so you're not talking about a one-time deal here. You're talking about a conduct over a period of time. It was deliberate conduct. It was conduct intended to cheat the government out of money that it was due. It was deceitful and probably borders on fraudulent conduct. And I mention that because there are a couple of cases that are cited in the brief out of Illinois and Maryland and Missouri in which the courts say, now, I know that the statute's not couched in terms of fraud, but it seems to us that the fact that you have to prove the willful intent to evade pretty much throws fraud into the circle, and there are a lot of jurisdictions that agree with that, and it's been universally held that fraud is moral turpitude, that if you engage in fraud, that's moral turpitude. It doesn't matter that it wasn't, that it didn't happen in your professional capacity. I see that my time is up. At this point, what we would ask the court to do is to reverse the finding of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, to render a finding that willful tax evasion is a crime of moral turpitude, and in doing so, also impose the mandatory imposition of disbarment, which is provided for in Rule 8.05.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear arguments from Appellate.
May it please the court, Mr. L. Charles Humphreys and Mr. Lloyd E. Humphreys will present arguments for Appellate. Mr. L. Charles Humphreys will open with the first 7 minutes.
May it please the court, I'm Lloyd Charles Humphreys, attorney for Lloyd Edwin Humphreys, also known as Buck Humphreys. I'm from Garland, just east of Dallas. I stand before you to represent my father. I think it is important in your decision to know the kind of man he is. I feel society is better off if he is allowed to continue to practice law. Today, your children are safer when you go shopping because shopping carts have been redesigned as a result of a case that my father won in Iowa. They're no longer inverted Vs, they're now stable, so when a child's standing on the edge of the shopping cart will not tip over. Also, judges today decide juveniles, whether juveniles should be prosecuted as adults or as minors rather than prosecutors as it once was. My father had the first case taken up on appeal and which led to that change. Iowa has also consolidated federal rules of court because my father, as the youngest chairman of the state bar committee, acted as editor of the first federal practice and procedure manual and edited the local rules so that consolidation was adopted. He also drafted one of the first public defender laws in the United States when he was working in Oregon in 1962. He became board certified in Texas after only 2 years here. In 30 years of practicing a law, he's never had any formal type of grievance action taken against him, and the convictions in these cases were politically motivated. It was in Iowa, it was a small town, by Dallas standards. My father was a very successful attorney, if not the most successful attorney, but he always was a solo practitioner. In fact, several of the prosecutors involved in this prosecution were hired by the law firm which he left when he started his own practice.
Your father takes the position that he was wrongfully convicted by the jury and denies his guilt to this day, doesn't he?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, there was one unqualified juror that was a member of that jury who had not had his civil rights restored, and under Texas law, just as I believe it's the Tweedle case and also the cheerleader case out of Houston holds, this conviction that my father suffered would have never happened in Texas. And we feel under the law of Texas, those convictions in Iowa are void.
Mr. Humphreys,
yes, sir.
Did your father exhaust all the appellate remedies in federal court?
Yes, Your Honor. We took it to the Eighth Circuit, and then we took it to the Supreme Court, where writ was recently denied. We're right now nearly ready to file a writ of habeas corpus.
So on the face of it, these are final convictions?
Yes, Your Honor. They are final convictions. And one thing that I believe had been asked earlier is whether or not the court should look behind a final conviction. And I feel that it's very important anytime you're considering a man's livelihood, his license to practice law, that you look at mitigating factors, that you don't just baldly say, okay, convicted, therefore can no longer practice. I think it's important that you look at it and consider reprimand, consider suspension, consider the alternatives, and look at what the man has done, and look at the facts of the case. Another big question is whether or not fraud was involved. The federal courts have held, when they have considered deportation cases, they're faced with the very same question. Should we deport this person based on tax evasion? And in several federal cases, from in particular a few that are cited on page 11 of my brief, as well as discussed in other portions, the federal courts interpreting moral turpitude and tax evasion have held this is not a crime of fraud. We're not going to deport based on this.
And there's no regard, not just the courts looking beyond the face of the conviction, but you think that the Board of Disciplinary Appeals, which is entrusted with looking at this area, needs to be able to do that?
Yes, Your Honor. And I really feel that in a few years from now, if the Honorable Court allows this decision to stand, a few years from now, there most likely would be other people with tax evasions. And I don't think it should be a hard and fast rule. If you're convicted of tax evasion, you keep your law license. I think it's very important that the Board of Disciplinary Appeals is given the opportunity to hear all the facts, all the evidence, what was involved in what the man did. And I think you'll find that many people that are convicted of tax evasion, they're going to get their license disbarred. I think this is 1 in 100 case. I think we have an extraordinary lawyer here who is going to be a tremendous asset to the state of Texas. And I firmly believe that he is one case where the facts justify the holding of the Board of Disciplinary Appeals.
Mr. Humphreys, I can understand your argument that this is 1 year, maybe 2 years. If this was 4 years, 83, 84, 88, and 89. So we're not talking about carelessness, or 1 year, or even 2 years.
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, the defense attorneys representing my father on this case relied on one defense. The accountants handled everything. My father was out of the accounting loop. The secretaries took all payments, recorded them in the books, and the accountants took care of all the paperwork and signed the accounts. In fact, we have exhibits in the records that show that the accountants handled
it. I'm sure that's a defense that was put up before the jury, and the jury didn't buy it.
Well, Your Honor, I've always believed in the jury system, and I have a real hard time reconciling this. And so, in regards to the convictions are there. We're still fighting them. The fact of the matter is he did pass the lie detector test, and based on all of his past contributions to the legal profession, to decapitate him from his possession and strip him of his law license at his age that he is right now, I think Boda, in looking at it, thinking about it, realized that they didn't want to do that. It was a close decision, but we're asking you to please allow their decision to stand.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the Court. I am Lloyd Humphreys. I stand before you with some embarrassment. I ask you to exercise your noblesse oblige in fulfilling your motto here. I think, first of all, it's important to understand that under the theory of this case, that this was a void judgment, and under the error or the point of error that has been presented to you, if you adhere strictly to the law, You could even rule in favor of the commission and still not reach the point that Boda exonerated me and this should be dismissed. We have a general final judgment that if it is supportable on any grounds, should be upheld. We're not standing before you as guilty. We're standing before you as innocent. Boda, who you delegated the authority to for questions of law and fact, found questions of law and fact, and those findings were general, that the law required this decision and the facts required this decision. They have only appealed one small point of error, and I might say that point of error that they appeal is contrary to the new rule standard of review. There is no point of error before you under substantial evidence, and at least two of the rules require that, 711 and 2.01, quote, judicial review, the case shall be reviewed under the substantial evidence rule. 2.21, such appeals must be on the record as determined under the substantial evidence rule. They have not called a point of error to your attention. I ask you, gentlemen, here not to apply a rule of lenity to me as a beggar. I ask you to uphold what you have said, the strict law. If you apply the strict law to my case, there can only be one decision, and that decision is that there is no discipline in my case under the compulsory rules.
Mr. Humphreys.
Yes, sir.
If Boda made an error of law, which we disagree with, and that is whether or not a willful failure to file income tax returns from 83, 84, 88, 89, are crimes involving moral turpitude, then Boda was wrong. And we can correct that error, can we not?
That error of law has to be brought to you under the substantial evidence rule, but you must also, as I understand it, from all the other cases and holdings, uphold Boda under the issue of facts. You see, the facts will substantiate that I was not guilty of this, both because of the juror issue not being valid, and also my innocence.
Mr. Humphreys, excuse me. My point is this. If a trial court makes an error of law, we can correct it. If Boda makes an error of law, we should be able to correct it, can we not?
I think you can correct it, Justice Gonzalez, but I don't think you can correct it and decapitate me. I would hope that this would be a celebration of life and not an epitaph or eulogy. But I would also suggest to you that the other problem in this case, here is basically standards that were put out into the State Bar of 1990. And what's happened is they cut off the entire process in my case. Here is the rules of what they're supposed to do in the diagram, and this has all been cut off. There is a constitutional right to a jury trial. I would be happy to try this case, and I can submit to you that I would be found to be innocent. But I have not got the right.
In essence, you want to retry your federal conviction before another jury.
No, I want to try the issue of moral turpitude. I'd be happy to do that. We have post-conviction relief pending right now. I have sued my accountants. I have sued the United States government in civil actions, and we are going to be litigating those issues. But what we're talking about here is simply moral turpitude. And what we're talking about here is Article 1, Section 5, the right to a jury trial in Texas. God bless the Republic. I'm entitled to that. They've cut me off. 81.077 specifically says you can't disbar a man without his right to a jury trial. At least, if you can't go along with the strict law in interpreting this matter, then I ask you to at least give me the right to a jury trial.
Mr. Humphreys, for us to declare that Boda was wrong on the law in this case, doesn't that essentially require us to announce a principle of law that Boda can never look beyond the conviction itself?
Yes, I think that it does, and I think that that would be an extremely harsh attitude, and also all the cases that I have found are opposed to that. I might also say that there is Texas state law. How this was overlooked, I don't know. But I also want you to know, I was released this morning, and I'm going to home confinement. And I haven't been home yet, but this is the core of my life and what I've done. We don't build bridges, gentlemen. We represent people. And in 31 years of representing people, I've never had any discipline. And this is not a grievance. This was something done by the prosecutor up there, who was later hired by my former firm, whose senior partner married my ex-wife. And the issue of alimony is involved in this. There's less than 5% of the gross income that's involved in each one of these, done by CPAs, done by bookkeepers, and done by my staff. But let me point out, State of Texas versus McVicker. June 30th, 77, 553-820. It's a holding of the Court of Appeals of Texas, and it's a writ NRE here. And that specifically held that disbarment is not compulsory upon a conviction for willfully and knowingly failing to file an income tax return. The intent of that offense is the same. And that's what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with the intent of that. In the state of Texas, would we allow Dostoevsky, Moses, Jesus Christ, St. Thomas Aquinas to practice law, Joseph of the biblical fame?
Are they convicted felons?
I beg your pardon?
Are they convicted felons?
I didn't understand.
Are they convicted felons?
Yes, in each and every case, they're convicted felons who serve time in prison. Now, whether they were Dietrich Bonhoeffer, whether these were crimes of moral turpitude, I don't know. But I will say there are 43 jurisdictions that do not agree with the few that she cited. And the federal jurisdiction in particular does not. And one of her arguments is that the district court of the, and these are lawyers considering disbarment proceedings where moral turpitude has been included. They're not necessarily immigration cases.
How long have you practiced law?
I practiced law since February of 1987, Your Honor. In any case,
you said you had some other Texas authority.
Well, the Texas authority essentially is this McVicker case, which was not cited before. And I submit to you that the intent is the same, but we also here have VOTA as a question of fact dealing with the circumstances, and the circumstances were part of this. You cannot simply consider, and this is, I don't want to, I've always stood forward and be counted. And I think if you look at my resume and what's happened, I tried to do the right thing and honor my duty. But I ask you not to decapitate me in order to prove a point. They are not entitled to appeal this, I submit to you, because if they are like any ordinary client, there must be injury. You must be making a decision which will allow them to have some sort of restitution of rights. And there is no restitution of rights here because all that has happened is I have been restored or I have been continued as an attorney. I think there's a real issue whether they have the right to appeal under these circumstances. And the appellate process that they have initiated is not one that allows Lloyd Humphreys to be disbarred because they have not dealt with the questions of fact decided by VOTA. If nothing else, if you would deprecate Lloyd Humphreys, at least uplift VOTA. These are gentlemen and women who you have appointed to these positions. And they have looked at this in more depth than we have the opportunity to do here today. And if you can't do that and apply the strict law, then at least give me the right to a jury trial. Do not become part of the conspiracy of this political issue.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
I would also just submit that I'm not waiving the other arguments contained in my brief because we have not touched on a number of them. Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, if I might address to you the same question that I raised opposing counsel, are you essentially asking us to adopt a rule of law here that VOTA can never look beyond the conviction?
In determining a lawyer's guilt or innocence, yes. I think the rule already provides that. And I believe, again, that my argument that the utility of using compulsory discipline would be lost.
How about
we don't,
I didn't mean to interrupt.
We don't bring compulsory discipline. I mean, the conviction is what forms the basis of the lawsuit. We don't bring it because somebody's been arrested or been indicted. They've actually been convicted of the crime. Whatever defenses they had to the crime have already been submitted to the trier of fact, in this particular case, obviously rejected.
Should VOTA be able, as a matter of law, to look beyond the conviction to determine whether moral turpitude was involved?
I don't believe so for the reasons that I stated earlier, and again, first of all, this court's held that it's strictly a question of law. Second of all, you're going to be in a situation where you've already held that theft, misappropriation, murder are in and of themselves because of the nature of the crime, because of the fact that they've been committed by lawyers. He looked at possession of cocaine without looking into the facts of the case. And you're in a position where now is it going to matter whether you stole a dollar or a million to determine whether or not it's moral turpitude?
Should Boda never be able to examine mitigation?
I believe that if they are in a situation in determining the appropriate discipline, in which they have the discretion to either suspend a lawyer or to disbar a lawyer, then I believe the facts of the case may be relevant. As I said earlier, it may make a difference whether you took a dollar or more in determining whether you should be suspended or be disbarred. So in those situations...
They should never be in a position, however, to dismiss if they think the circumstances of the particular case warrant no suspension or no disbarment at all.
They have two determinations to make. One, is it a crime, if it fits within this area, is it a crime of moral turpitude? Well, I guess I should say, is it an intentional crime as provided for by statute? If it is not, it goes away. And I think that you make that determination based upon the elements of the crime and the fact that a lawyer committed a crime and the other things that I set out.
Counsel, can Boda look at whether or not a crime is moral turpitude in another jurisdiction? And we have an unusual situation here because of the convictions in another jurisdiction. If that's a crime of moral turpitude in the other jurisdiction but not in Texas, is that something Boda can consider?
If you're referring to State versus McVicker that was brought up by Mr. Humphreys, I want to point out that State versus McVicker was not a finding that failure to file was not moral turpitude. That was a misdemeanor offense. And under our statute, at the time, a serious crime was either a felony involving moral turpitude or a misdemeanor involving theft, embezzlement, or misappropriation. And what the court actually held was that misdemeanor offense of the failure to file didn't fit within the definition. It wasn't theft, it wasn't embezzlement, it wasn't misappropriation of fiduciary property, and therefore it did not come within the definition necessary in order to bring a compulsory discipline action.
That's interesting, but I haven't read McVicker, and I wasn't referring to it.
Oh, okay.
If a lawyer now in Texas has a final conviction in another jurisdiction for a crime that is a crime of moral turpitude in that jurisdiction but is not a crime of moral turpitude in Texas, what is the position that Boda is to take? And this is hypothetical question.
The position I think that Boda would have to take would be to determine whether to give, I suppose, our jurisdiction more weight than however many other jurisdictions have determined whether or not it's moral turpitude, whether or not our jurisdiction took into account the fact that it was committed by a lawyer.
So this is something that there's at least some play on, and whether it's Boda or the Supreme Court that has to decide that.
Well, in this particular instance, I don't believe that...
Please.
I'm sorry.
I'm not talking about this
crime. Okay.
I'm talking about another jurisdiction, another person.
I apologize.
But a crime that is a crime of moral turpitude in that jurisdiction, but not in Texas. That's a determination that in your mind, that question is open.
Yes, it is open.
All right. Then... in this case, if Mr. Humphreys is correct that this conviction was a conviction by a juror who was not entitled to sit, and it would be an absolutely void conviction in Texas, although apparently not a void conviction in federal district court in Iowa, is that something that either Boda or this court can take into account?
I believe that Boda can take into consideration the validity of the conviction. So it seems to me that may be the issue.
That's right.
That you're
and do they judge that by Iowa federal district court standards or by Texas state trial court standards?
I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. I have not thought about that.
Any other questions?
Thank you,
counsel. That concludes the argument in this call. All the foregoing causes you've heard this morning are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Oh yeah. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.